So that's the first thing I want to do. The second thing I want to do is ask a question, which I first asked a year ago, and I'm really very surprised very few people are asking, which is not how do we get into the crisis, but how do we get out of the last one? So everybody talks about the falling rate of profit, but before the profit rate fell, it rose. And that seems to me to be rather important thing. Why did it rise? And very few people ask that question. And this is where the Schumpeterianism comes in, because there are two previous, or three at least, depending on which school of Schumpeterianism you belong to, three, four, or five previous occasions on which this has happened, in which the rate of profit has sharply risen. There has been a period of 20 or so years of accelerated growth of capitalism. There has been an expansion of capabilities, which is the third thing I'm going to come on to, followed by a long period of decline. So in each case, what the Cassandras amongst us tend to focus on is the going down, but it's rather important to focus on the coming up as well. And there's a very old debate, not old, but very important debate, which took place between Kondratiev and Trotsky. It's reported in a wonderful book called The Crisis and the Crash by Richard B. Day, about the debates amongst the Russian Marxists in the 1920s, in which Trotsky's response to Kondratiev was that the Kondratiev cycle, which is a statistically established fact, is not governed by the same laws as the business cycle. So the business cycle has an automatic element to it. It simply goes up and down in the way that a pendulum swings. And Trotsky says that Kondratiev's error is to suppose that the rise is caused by endogenous, as it's called within the Schumpeterian discourse, by some automatic process. And Trotsky says no. Every time there's a restoration of the profit rate, it is accomplished by political means. Wars, revolutions, reorganization of the system of national states, a tremendous intervention of classes and states, a clash, and a new stage, in a certain sense, a new stage of civilization is launched. It's a step change in everything that goes on. So if that's the case, then it's the political interventions that we should be looking at if we want to understand how the rate of profit went up. And the third thing I want to do, which arises from, in a certain sense, a preoccupation I do as an advisor to the Mayor of London with responsibility for the culture and creative industries, is to urge people to rethink the whole way in which we understand the role of human capacity in relation to productivity. And this very much connects up with this whole notion of the stationary state, because if we think in terms of human capacity, the stationary state is not at all stationary. On the contrary, the ideal for me, socialist stationary state, would be precisely the one which Oscar Wilde describes in The Soul of Man Under Socialism, which Marx also described, which is the state in which the full self-realisation of the free individual is finally actually possible. And that is an expansion of activity, and it can well be accompanied by an expansion of economic activity. It's very important to understand that. And tied to that is that I think that the role of human capacity, the expansion of capacities which at the early stage of the boom are confined to a small group of rich, one of the things that happens in these booms is that those things get expanded to a much wider range of people. That's basically what the welfare state did. It took things which people could do previously when they were wealthy and made it possible for a much larger number of people to do even when they were poor. And what I think is missing, because of what I call the machinocratic conception, which Marx himself criticised, and what Andrew Kleiman and myself has called the physicalist outlook, the notion that economic activity consists solely of the production of things, which is false, it actually consists of the production of values, which can be, as Marx says at the right at the beginning of Volume 1, can come, it doesn't matter where use value comes from the belly or from the pure imagination, it's still a use value if it constitutes a relation between humans. What's missing is the understanding that when those capacities of humans are extended, the consequence is a massive upgrading of the productivity of people. And in fact, I think most of what I call civilizational steps forward, which have been going on for quite a long time, have been very fundamentally misunderstood, because if you look at where productivity really rose, it came from an upgrading of the capacities of the human beings who work the machines and not the machines themselves. And I'll just give two examples. the Hindu Arabic numeral system, which is the nearest I know to a pure mental upgrade in human capacity. Now, I used to do this with my first year math 101 math students in economics. I used to say, multiply in your head XIV and MCM X11. And now multiply in your head the same thing with Hindu Arabic numbers. And in Treviso, a little town in Italy, in 1346, if you read Jacob Swett's wonderful history of arithmetic, this was the centre of attention of the whole of the medieval business world, because people had the problem of changing money in the fares that took them from Sweden all the way down to the Volga, and they had to change money about six times. There were very heavy transaction costs. The biggest part of the transaction cost was they couldn't multiply XIV by CIV. And so that people said, look, you know, if you want to become sort of morally competent, go and study in the church, but if you want to learn business, go to Treviso and learn this new Hindu Arabic number system, because it will multiply your productivity by 100. And it did. And it was a step change in the productivity. The next thing, everybody talks about the book. But excuse me, if a book is going to function, people need to be able to read it. So what happened to literacy? Everybody talks about the Victorian machine age. But what about the three R's? Reading, writing, and arithmetic. What about the capacities that the welfare state created by giving everybody simply education to age 16? And in fact, one of the things that one gets as a result of being a civil servant is the privilege of sort of being the fly on the wall in meetings between sort of politicians and economists. And every now and again, the fly gets to speak, particularly in moments of crisis. So I was at one of these meetings with a couple of ministers and a few vice chancellors, and we were studying the economic impact of education. And somebody turned to us and said, well, you know, audience participation. Well, I said, well, I think the single biggest thing you could do in this crisis is to raise the school leaving age to 21. Now you think about that. Okay. You'd have to build a university in every town above 15,000 inhabitants. You'd have to invest massively in things that I'm sure people in this room would be very interested in investing in, like classrooms, lecturers, and so on. That would be an increase in production. And it would necessitate an increase in consumption. It would be a fiscal stimulus. But it would be producing things that we're not accustomed to thinking of as production. So that, in a nutshell, is the argument. I may actually have finished, but I did prepare some slides, so I'll see if we can go through them. And how long have I got now?
About 11 minutes.
Okay, well, that's quite good. I can show you some flash graphics. But I've now outlined the argument, so you can cut me off at any time. A few questions. This is a graph of the profit rate. Now, you were shown this graph from here onwards by Andrew Kleiman. Well, actually, Andrew's extended it to here, as have I. But this is an early one, actually, oddly enough, taken from Dumin and Levy. And what we can see is a couple of very interesting things. There are periods which launch what are basically Kondratiev booms. This launched the Belle Epoque boom, the 1879 period, followed by a fairly long period of stagnation. Then another sudden surge, followed by a long, slow period of stagnation. So the issue is, what produced this and what produced that? And I want an attempt, a conceptual inversion. You see, what's interesting is the language we use to talk about crisis. We describe this as exceptional, and that as normal. Perhaps this is normal and that is exceptional. But because it holds out for a prospect of a civilization we have never dreamed of and that most of us subsequently immediately deprived of, we hold out the Golden Ages as being the normal. Actually, that's a rather nice thing about humans. You know, we aspire to the best and not to the worst. Okay, but nevertheless, in terms of strict scientific objectivity, I do wonder whether we shouldn't be saying that actually the booms are exceptional and thinking about them in that way and thinking about what happens in booms as an exceptional event. As indeed, you know, fiscal stimulus is actually an exceptional event in terms of the way that capitalism organises itself. What worries me about this is now the following. This is where the US economy actually recovered. This starts in 1929 and it goes to 1950, and the figures that I want to draw your attention to are unemployment, the red line, which didn't really get below the 15% mark until well into 1939, after 1939. The role of, I haven't put output on here, but it's very similar. It basically doesn't really take off till about here. But secondly, the role of the state and the role of private investment. Because what happened is private investment, this blue line, collapsed during the war and was massively overtaken by government spending. And most of that, by the way, was investment. You can track the growth of capital stock. And you simply find that the state takes over as investor from private capital during the war. What worries me about that, said all that, and then we get a step change. And things go on at a higher rate after that, which is when Fordism and the welfare state. So something happens that preserves that, which is very important. It's part of the boom, I think, is the welfare state. That was what was going on. It was the war that rescued capital. What lay behind the boom of 1893? Very, very simply, imperialism. So it seems as if the way that in the past private capitalism has launched booms is actually to launch on two operations. One is to take a number of products previously only available to a relatively small number of the citizens of the rich countries and extend those, universalise them to the working class, to introduce a whole new pattern of mass consumption. But secondly is to barbarise its competitors and the rest of the world. The two have hitherto gone together. Which is one of the reasons I am very sanguine about the prospects of launching a new boom. First of all, because of my view that it's actually an exceptional thing. Secondly, because it has to be launched by political events. And thirdly, because so far the only political events which have launched booms have been bloody wars of depredation and conquest. So I hope we're at a different stage of history. But if we are, it will be a new stage of history. If we launch a boom this time, if capitalism launches a boom, it will have entered a totally new period of its growth, and we can basically tear up most, in my opinion, most of the theory that we've been using so far. Okay, now, there follows a small amount of stuff explaining why this makes sense to Marxism, which would be of interest about five people in this room. But basically, there is a Marxist argument which encompasses that, and it says that the state is a non-productive investor in Marxist terms. Non-productive gets a bad press. Under socialism, nobody would be productive in Marxist terms, because there would be nothing would be bought and sold as a commodity. Okay, so let's hear it for unproductive labour is my slogan. Onward to freeing the human race by making everybody unproductive. Which may be quite close to sort of Keynes' notion of sufficiency, actually, in a certain sense. You know, we're not compelled by selling and buying. And what the state does is it increases the productive capacity of the economy, but it does it by displacing the private investor completely. And then at the end, when it launches the actual quadrative, it hands that back to the private investor, but I've done the dark side. So just this quote, just saying, the way that it was conceptualised in the times of imperialism, I like to show that to people, because I think some people are not sufficiently shocked at what the imperial mode of thinking was. This is Rhodes, and he's saying this is how we're going to do it, and he describes, this is 80 years after the abolition of slavery. He says, what we need is the cheap slave labour of the colonies. So, whatever is being done that's progressive at home is not conceived that that's what's being done abroad. Yet, at the same time, these were the radical reformers. These people began as the left wing of liberalism, the Birmingham commercial people. He launched this radical programme way to the left of anything else except, you know, sort of lunatic socialists. Universal education, social housing. Everybody was going to get 3 acres and a cow. I'm still waiting for my cow. Yeah. This is going to be financed. Well, maybe we'll realise that with a sustainable economic revolution. Finally realise Cecil Rhodes' slogan. I don't know about the 3 acres. And all that was going to be financed by colonial revenues. Very important to understand that there's a bright, dark side and a bright side. But let's look at the bright side, and then the slogan of socialism will be bright side, not just for the imperialists, but for everybody. And here's the argumentation as to why it's good. Well, they introduced lots of new gadgets, which only rich people got access to before. But they also introduced new forms of social consumption, health, education, mental consumption, essentially, and all sorts of reforms such as minimum wage, right to work, pensions, things that were actually enshrined in the concept of an extension of rights. One of the ways of thinking about economics is to look at the way that political rights are perceived through the ages. So you begin with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Then you move on to bread, peace, and land. I mean, these pretty minimal demands, basically. Then you get the Charter of Human Rights, which is still, I mean, if we only implemented the Charter of Human Rights, we would be living on a different planet, where, you know, universal right to education, universal right to health, universal right to a decent old age, to housing, it's very material demands. It actually lays out a programme of mass expansion of consumption, if you think about it as an economist, to actually provide what the rights that are in the Charter of Human Rights, you would have to produce on a scale on 400 people that we've not done, and not necessarily material goods. Very important to understand that. Not necessarily material goods, including civil. What did the state actually invest in? Health, education, the arts council founded by Keynes, housing, yes, some material element, creativity and education of kids, ideas, innovation, science and so on. Fundamentally, this is actually my Facebook sign. It's shot in Ottawa, okay? And there is actually a Facebook. The market is to the right and civilization is forward. Okay? So this is the Marxist, you know. Fundamentally, these civilized values are counterposed to the market. But that's a very peculiar thing to do. And here's the graph that I assiduously collected. This, since 1948, the share of labour in the advanced countries engaged in services. So in the US, this is now well above 80. In even the most manufacturing of countries, Japan, it's well above 60. And most interestingly of all, 3 minutes or stop? 2 minutes, that's great, okay. Not a lot of people know this, but the share of manufacturing employment in China, polluter of the world, has actually fallen from 20 to 11%. What's gone up is services. Now, there's a bit of elision going on here, because I'm not saying that services are not consumers of material resources. I'm not saying that, okay? And I'm not saying that services are necessarily wonderful in terms of reversing all the relations of capital. In fact, many of much service production under capital actually worsens the hierarchies and inequalities that you find under capitalism. So I'm not saying this is the answer to everything, but what I'm saying is that we do appear to be in a new phase of capitalistically organised production in which a substantial amount of value is not produced in the form of materials at all. Now, what would happen and what would be necessary in order for that to be generalised? In order to have a universalisation of the highest achievements of capitalism so far? Well, basically you'd have to make human rights recognised as productive. If you invest in skills, health, what you do is reduce the costs of the working class. Actually, you reduce the costs to the private employer, something that's pointed out to me by a Canadian economist. He said typically the wages of an auto worker in the Canadian auto industry is $1,500 lower than in the US, which would be a useful figure for Daniel. You know, because that represents the marginal cost of social health insurance, or the marginal benefit of social health insurance. So this was an investment. People became more productive because they were educated. They could do a wider variety of things and be more efficient at what they did. Because they were more healthy, they were not a burden on the health industry. Because they were not unemployed, they didn't burden down, drawing down welfare. Because they could live longer, the cost of elderly care. These were not a drain. These were an advance. But somehow there was something about the way that private capital organised that made it unable to realise those gains. So, can I have half a minute to finish? This is my final slide. Where are we at? Well, I used to read J.D. Burnell's World Without War when I was a kid, I don't know if you remember this, and he calculated how much you would have to cut off the cost of war in order to feed everybody. And I was very fascinated by this issue, because the problem was the world was not producing enough. The world is now producing enough. Average income worldwide, very badly distributed, is actually equal to the average Western average in 1950. So if we distributed it properly, without expanding any more the uses, the depletion of resources of the Earth, we could feed everybody on this planet to the standards of the Golden Age, which is sort of something to think about. Most of the production would be not material. In actual fact, what you could have is, I keep emphasising this, that technical revolutions do not necessarily mean producing more. You can produce the same for less. That's a technological revolution as well. That's what a green revolution would be. So let's suppose we take all this, we working services, access to advanced services such as a massive expansion of care, green style investment, resource reducing rather than consumption increasing. How do you make these things a goal, a platform, a manifesto? You make them rights. You make them rights. You make everybody accountable, including private investors, as to whether or not they provide things. These things. So I summarised these, and it's gone. I've lost them. Oh yeah, here it is. My new Charter of Human Rights. You see, we take all what we've got so far: life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, solidarity, charter, UN charter, and we add the right to care, the right to create, and the right to sustain. And then you say the task of all citizens, governments, private corporations, is to guarantee those rights to every human being on the planet. That's a sort of brief manifesto for socialism, I suppose. But if the capitalists can do it, I would be very happy.